The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Wu Men's Gateless Gate Koan Collection. Zhangyan's Person of a Tree, the main case. Master Zhangyan said, it's like a person of a tree who hangs from a branch by their mouth. Their hands cannot grasp a bough. Their feet cannot touch the tree. Somebody else comes under the tree and asks them the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West. If they don't answer, then they don't meet the questioner's need. If they do answer, they will lose their life. At such a time, how should you answer? The commentary. Even though your eloquence flows like a river, it's all to no avail. Even if you can expound the great Tripitaka, it is also of no use. If you can really answer this, you will revive the dead and kill the living. If, however, you are unable to answer, wait for Maitreya to come and ask him. The poem. No sense at all. Vile and poisonous, beyond all bounds. Zhangyan stuns every student mute. His entire body is one killer demon eye glare. So before I get into the koan, we celebrated Buddha's birthday this morning and the founding day. So it was around this time in 1980 that Dada Roshi first came upon this property and this building, and was looking for a place to establish a Dharma center, was not looking for a place quite this big. But when he came upon this property, it was just so, well. And even though he knew it was a bit mad, because he had very few resources and a very small sangha, even to speak of it, his wife, one of his sons, a mailing list of students who used to study with him when he was teaching photography. And so it began. They moved in September, and they began practicing right away and establishing originally an art center. He was working with somebody else, an artist. They were going to have a sort of Dharma based art center, but it pretty quickly shifted emphasis into being more of just a sort of primary focus being training center, Dharma center, and with an emphasis on the arts. So I'm feeling very appreciative of him this morning for doing that, because it was a monumental task that required a great many skills and an ongoing commitment and devotion and perseverance, in a sense, against many odds. But he had a very strong both commitment to the Dharma, love for the Dharma, faith in the Dharma, and in the ability, the potential for what a training center, which became in his mind a monastery, could do, could be for those who were drawn, who wanted to encounter the Dharma, study it, practice it, make their life in it. So what he went about creating was, of course, drawing on all of his training with his own teachers, but also creating something that he hadn't himself experienced. He trained in a residential setting in San Francisco, Los Angeles, but it wasn't a monastery in the way that we have developed. And so he was then drawing on his earlier years of, you know, studying with Jesuit monks and nuns when he was a schoolboy, but really creating, establishing a way of training for us that he himself had not gone through. So we were, you know, kind of sorting it out. The Buddha lived a life dedicated to humanity, really, to the particular experience of being a human being. And he realized, he understood that everything that is conditioned, which in Buddhism means is dependent upon other forces or other things to come into existence. And what the Buddha realized is that that describes everything. Nothing exists by itself. Nothing comes into being by itself. Everything appears in the world, in the universe, as a result of different forces, different agents, different objects, different actions working together to bring that forth. And therefore, all conditioned things are empty of any absolute self-existence, autonomous force or influence or agency, because it's all conditioned, dependent arising. And that everything that is of that nature, which is everything, ultimately in our experience of those things, leads to disappointment and discontentment, to dissatisfaction, because there's nothing that we can create or achieve or learn or know or accomplish that will give us a permanent source of happiness or contentment or fulfillment. They can bring us ephemeral experiences of those things. They can provide us with those things on an impermanent basis, but not ultimately. And so the Buddha said, if we're trying to rely on those things for a ongoing, ultimate sense of fulfillment, happiness, contentment, whatever it is we're ultimately seeking, we will be disappointed. That's dukkha, the Buddha said. And so in Buddhism, particularly in Mahayana Buddhism, there's a lot of teachings about dualities, which can sound kind of dry and technical and philosophical. We're born and we will die. We seek happiness, but we're often sad. We want to be authentic, but we can see ourselves as being contrived. We want to belong, but can feel estranged. We want to have a meaningful life, but oftentimes wonder if it is or might feel like it's not. There is good and bad, right and wrong. We want to be generous, but we might not have enough. We want to be trusting, but then we get hurt. We see how helpful it is to be confident in what we do, but we feel insecure. We turn inward, but can then reject the world. We take care of the world, but then we can get lost to ourself. There is self and other. There is self and other, there is self and other. What makes these dualities in Buddhism? It's not just that different things exist. It's that they exist in opposition. And they exist in our minds in a more permanent state, which means you have to constantly make a choice and assess whether you are good or are you bad. Is this right or is this wrong? Are you honest or dishonest? Is your practice strong or is it weak? Are you making progress or not? So we're constantly encountering these ultimate, dualities, these points where we have to decide what side of the fence are you going to be on? And we experience this very quickly in Zazen, where we sit and we have some intention and we see ourselves in a certain way. I'm basically a good person. You're basically a good person. And then we encounter things in our sitting that seem to suggest perhaps otherwise. Things that we've done, things that we think about ourselves, about others, and we have a problem. A duality, how I see myself and how I see myself. Which is the correct one? So there's this ceaseless vacillation between one side and the other. The faith mind says, live neither in the entanglements of outer things nor in the attachment to emptiness. Zhanyan was a 10th century Chinese master. And he studied with Guishan, who was another very well-known master at that time. Guishan once said to him, I'm not asking you about what you've read, what the teachings are that you've heard. Say something from the time before you were born and before you could discern any objects. speak from that place. And Xianyan was confused and couldn't answer and sat there deep in thought. And then he said, would the teacher please explain this to me? And Guishan said, whatever I could say would merely be my own understanding. How could it help you? It would be my understanding. It wouldn't be your understanding. And so Xianyan returned to his room and went through all of his books and his texts and his sutras, but he couldn't find anything that would help. And he said, a picture of a cake cannot satisfy hunger, a well-known phrase in the Zen tradition, which Dogen turned on its head, so it seems, and says, no, painted cakes do satisfy hunger because all things are non-dual. But we're not going to get into that right now. And then he burned all of his books and said, during this lifetime, I won't study the doctrine anymore. I'll just become an ordinary monk. And so he went to the cemetery of previous national teacher, Nanyang, and thought he would just take care of that gravesite. So he lived a very simple life. And one day he was raking, keeping the site clean, and a pebble. He flicked a pebble up and it hit a piece of bamboo and made a sound. And at that moment, he had an opening. He realized himself. And then said he turned in the direction of Guishan and bowed to him and said, my teacher's great compassion exceeds that even of one's parents. Back then, if you had explained it to me, this would have never come to pass. Because he would have had this idea of something that would have gotten lodged in his mind, that then he would have been looking for that. But in his sort of exhaustion of everything he knew, in which he decided to be just an ordinary common monk tending to this gravesite, but in which clearly his seeking was not finished. He was clearly very much still on the path. Otherwise, that moment would not have occurred. And so one day he said to his sangha, it's like a person up a tree. They're holding on to the branch by their mouth. They can't grab at the trunk. And somebody comes below and says, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? Now, this is a traditional question, which basically means, what is enlightenment? What is the enlightened mind? What is the fundamental truth? And so this person wants to know. And it says, if the person in the tree answers, they're going to fall to their death. If they don't answer, then they don't meet the needs of the person on the ground. So what do they do? We raise bodhicitta, the aspiration to alleviate the suffering of self and other. That in the Mahayana tradition, our liberation is seen as not just inextricably bound, but unified with everyone else. And it was the idea of being self-liberated, completely enlightened when there's still suffering in the world, right? That we in a sense, practice to enlighten ourselves and others at the same time. And so, having such an aspiration, what do we do about this kind of a moment? Right? Where whatever step we take, someone will fall. Something will not be addressed. We try to help someone, but it makes other people angry. We try to make everybody happy, no one's happy. We try to avoid conflict, other problems appear. We create conflict and just peace grows further and further away. Who gets taken care of? How do we find our place, our peace? The Buddha said dukkha, what we translate as suffering or disappointment, dissatisfaction, is not having what you want, not being with who you want, having something you don't want, being with somebody you'd rather not be with. Very ordinary things happen all the time. At such a time, how do you respond? In our zazen, as we're developing our mindfulness and letting that develop into concentration, there are times where that becomes very deep into a state of samadhi and we lose awareness of time, place, person. At some point, awareness returns, right? We become aware again. But within samadhi, within a deeper state of concentration, what we're really cultivating is as that deepens, there is an aspect of our awareness which is still present. And the essential aspect of this awareness that is possible because of that state of concentration, because of the state of mind that has been brought into such a deep state of stillness, non-agitation, non-reactivity, right, is that that awareness is able to be aware without discriminating. And so how can we be aware but not discriminate? So if we think of awareness, of having the natural capacity to be aware and see and just see. Think of discriminating awareness as when your mind sees and names and has opinions about and divides and compares and judges and ranks. That's discriminating consciousness. And that's the consciousness which we're trying to calm, to free ourselves of, because it's habitual, right? It becomes habitual. Even when we need to be able to judge or to name or to, you know, criticize for that matter, can we do that without deluding ourselves and that which we're seeing? Students ask the Buddha, if the self is empty of any intrinsicness, then why do you use the pronoun I? And he said, it's a convenient designation. Mm-hmm. It's useful. But to use it without imputing into it a false sense of self-existence. And so we, as we become more clear, we're able to work within the world that could very easily be deluding, but we move through that world knowingly. The words don't delude our mind. The words don't create separation. And of course, we live in a time, I mean, you know, discriminating consciousness has always been around. There's nothing particularly new about it. But we live in a time of great discrimination of consciousness. We have various skin colors, black and brown and white. We have various genders, female, male, trans, non-binary. We have various sexualities, lesbian, gay, queer, straight. Various political views, various geographical, urban, rural, various ways of understanding education and people who are educated or not, various classes, various religions. We seem to have no lack of ability to categorize people and people put people into various categories. And in that, we may be there is the potential to just recognize qualities, features, attributes. That's a natural aspect of the mind. Discriminating consciousness sees that and divides one from the other. It imputes meaning. Because you appear this way, because you have this political view, because you sexuality is comes forth in you in this way, that means something about who you are and separates you by virtue of that distinction, by virtue of that quality. That's not in any of those attributes. It's not in any of those qualities. It's something that is actively and all too passionately being created and employed almost always to someone's detriment. The faith mind says, one thing, many things, move among them freely without discrimination. So how can we think of that, right? Because we are different. We have differences. Hallelujah, right? I remember somebody who was in residence many years ago, and they said, you know, if I ever found somebody who was exactly like me, I would marry them in an instant. I thought, well, thank you for your honesty. Not quite sure how that would work out, but what are you doing with all the rest of us, you know? So thank goodness that there are so many differences. I was reading something from Thich Nhat Hanh recently that I thought spoke of this well. He said, the wisdom of non-discrimination is within each of us. It's a natural aspect of our mind. That's what Zazen is helping to reveal. He said, for example, my right hand writes poetry with a pen. My right hand has this wisdom of non-discrimination. It never tells my left hand, you don't seem to be good at anything. I'm the one who's writing the poem. I'm the one who's practicing calligraphy. What are you doing? No, my right hand never considers herself separate or superior to my left hand. That's why communication and collaboration between the two hands is so perfect. There's no feeling of superiority, inferiority, or even of equality. When we compare, we see ourselves as high or low, as trying to be, or as trying to be equal, which is why trying to be equal is good, but tentative, precarious, impermanent. It's good as long as we decide to try and see things through equality. That can change in any minute. But with this kind of comparing comes discrimination, and with discrimination comes suffering. He says, the cells in our body collaborate with each other without discrimination. One day my left hand was holding a nail and my right hand was holding a hammer. I was trying to hang a picture. I was not very mindful, and so I pounded the hammer on my finger. And right away, my right hand put the hammer down and took care of my left hand. as if it was taking care of itself. My left hand didn't get angry at my right hand. What the? Because it's endowed with the wisdom of non-discrimination. My right hand didn't say, I'm taking care of you, left hand. I do care about you, but you know, now you owe me one. There's no you, no I, no discrimination. They are the same. But wait a minute. But they're different. One is left and one is right. So in Buddhism, there have been many ways of trying to help us understand conceptually how can non-duality be the nature of all things in a world of such profound variation and differences. We could think, well, everything is equal, everything is the same, or everything is different. You have to choose. But that's just another duality. How can they be the same? Another very common image is of the ocean, where the ocean is your self-nature. It's unified. It's one great body. Has no boundaries. But it gives rise to waves because of different factors, conditions, causes. Waves appear, and the waves are different. There's one, there's another one, there's another one, there's another one. This one is just rising, this one is falling. One is large, one is small. But you can't have one by itself. You can't take a wave home with you. We wouldn't even think of that, right? It'd be ludicrous. How can there be sameness, unity, one nature, and difference? This is why we're in a hall of Buddha's awakening and not in a classroom, studying the ideas and the concepts, although I am speaking of those concepts. I'm speaking of it conceptually. Our meditation is to take, in a sense, those ideas, those teachings, which have been, thank goodness, you might say, translated into what you can do with your whole person, what you can do with your mind, with your intention, with your aspiration, what you can do with that conceptual understanding to make it realize, to make it actualize, so that it's a direct experience. Because as the commentary says, even though my eloquence might flow for a river, it's limited. I can know that I have Buddha nature. I can know that all things fundamentally are empty, that my suffering doesn't exist anywhere by itself, that when you say something mean-spirited and I get angry, that you haven't made me angry, that when I see you and my discriminating mind puts you into a category, that's not in you. I can know those things, but I still do those things, right? Because knowing them is not strong enough. And so we practice embodying, being that non-discriminating mind and responding to things more and more with non-discriminating consciousness. When we don't do that, when we respond with discriminating consciousness, as Thich Nhat Hanh said, and with discrimination comes suffering. How do you know? When something arises, something in you, you don't like, and you start judging it. How does that feel? So we're seeing it. When discriminating consciousness is functioning, and the stronger it functions, the more righteously it functions, the greater the suffering. And we're seeing a whole heap of that. They work together. But in the same way, as that discriminating consciousness starts to settle down a little bit, it's still there, but it's not so virulent. It's not so righteous. So our understanding can temper, in a sense, the power of that discriminating consciousness. It's still in the body. We're still reacting as though it's true, but we're able to have a little bit of attachment and realize, oh, this is my habit. This is my karma. This is not true in the sense of being an absolute. It begins to temper that, right? And as that tempers, the suffering is lessened. It's showing us, we're seeing the direct relationship. And so, it's like a person hanging from a tree. That person's still there, by the way, asking this question. Of course, having a sense of self, we cling to that self, we build it up, defend it, preserve it, and now here's a moment, right? Somebody needs our help, but, you know, I'm kind of engaged here. Like, this is very inconvenient, you asking me this question, right? Could you come back later? No. I need to know now. And so that sense of self, even though we want to be generous, we want to take care of this person, but wait a minute. What about me? The enlightened being does not disregard this person, just like the left hand does not disregard the right. It takes care of one's body and mind, one's health. When we misaim the hammer and the hand is hurting, we tend to that, right? And we take better aim, right? But how is it when we're free from the fear and the anxiety and the attachment that discriminating consciousness is an expression of? Because attachment is always anxious. There's always anxiety in our attachments. Why else would we do it? What are we trying to preserve? What are we trying to avoid? We already know we're going to lose this. We can't keep it, so we're anxious. We already know that we're in the presence of something we don't want, so that brings fear. How is it when that's dissolved? When no hindrance in the mind, no hindrance, no fear. In that sense, when we become more and more free from clinging to self and other, in a way, everything becomes more important, but not because it's important to me, for me, about me, but important in its own way, because it itself is complete, has its own dignity, is in its own Dharma state, and that's true about this as well, and the one that's sitting on your cushion. But rather than just, you know, I want to take care of this so I can get as much as I can and keep it as long as I can, it becomes more so that I can let my life be one of service, give. And the freer we are, the more freely we can give. And so at such a time, presented with such a situation, how would you answer? There is a person in the tree, there is a person on the ground. The person in the tree is whole and complete and boundless. The person on the ground is whole and complete and boundless. Standing or hanging doesn't have anything to do with it. Holding on or letting go doesn't change this. So where exactly is the conflict? When a person risks their life to help a stranger, in that very moment are they thinking, I'm going to risk my life to help you? Probably sometimes. That's a very courageous act. At other times, it may be more like the left hand, going to the right hand, without thought. You know, it's like if you're walking with somebody and they stumble, do you think, you know, I really don't have time for this. You know, we were headed somewhere. No, we don't think it. We react, we respond. What is that? That's compassion. That's selfless generosity. It doesn't need a thought. It doesn't need calculation. So for the person in the tree, do they deny the person on the ground? Or do they deny themselves? See, this every way we look at this way, we're going to end up with just another expression of the same duality. Who comes first? If we respond without denying and forsaking, if we respond without discriminating consciousness, how do we transcend that duality? It doesn't mean being in two places at once. It's not magic. It actually means being in one place at once. And that one place is not divided. That one place is the whole thing. In that moment, right and wrong can't be found. And so in that moment, when someone helps someone, and there is no right and wrong, it's not heroic. It's the left hand helping the right hand. They're the same body. They don't know right and left. But that action might save a person's life. For the person who notices that, that's heroic. That's also true. The empty nature of things is always moving in accord with time and place. Always. That's why everything, including us, fundamentally in our nature, is at peace with ourselves and the world. That's our basic state. Buddha nature is just another way of expressing that. To say that we're at peace brings a little bit of complication because that seems like a certain state, right, that could be lost. It's not that kind of peace. It's not the peace that is won at the end of a battle. It's not the peace that is the result of a treaty. It doesn't even know peace. It's just a basic state. But the dualistic mind struggles with the world of differences. You know, I was saying to those of you who were in the session I had yesterday, something else that I was reading with Thich Nhat Hanh, where he said, you know, when we're struggling with something within ourselves and we react in a habitual way, you know, we react with anger, we react with fear, we react with self-criticism, whatever. He said, really what's happening is we just don't know how to deal with what we're feeling. We don't know how to respond to what we're experiencing. In a way, we don't have another alternative. And so we respond the way we know. We respond habitually. Because that's always right there. And in a way, it's the easiest thing to do. If we don't actually apply some effort, that's what we'll do. Right? But it's really, if it's just a different way of looking at it, it's really just, I don't know how to work with this. And so I just revert back to what I do know. And it's another way of thinking about when we see other people acting badly, that it's confusing. Why would you do that? Why are you this way? Why are you destroying the world? Or other people's lives. And he said, that person too is suffering. Because when we see suffering created in the world, it originates in suffering. So in a sense, that person too doesn't know what to do with what they're experiencing. And the way they respond to that is by externalizing it, which is very often what we do. We also can internalize it. But it also may be that that person doesn't even know what they're experiencing. They don't know what they're feeling. They're just reacting. It doesn't even get to the level of, oh, I am experiencing this. I don't know what to do. And so I go back to habit. It's not even at that level. And I found that very helpful, you know, as a way of just saying, oh, it's rather than just, you know, this person is willfully choosing to be so destructive, to be so hateful, to be so angry, to create so much suffering, right? That in a way that's true. There is willfulness. People are making decisions. They are doing those things that have those consequences. But to really look at it and say, but that is a response to really not knowing how to handle the experience of being this human being in this moment with this arising. And so it can help us to just hold ourselves and others in a larger way with a different perspective, which is by nature more compassionate. We're all still accountable. That doesn't go away. Bad actions still need to be dealt with. That doesn't go away. But it helps us to deal with that, our own discriminating consciousness, which seeing hatred becomes hateful. Experiencing anger becomes angry, right? Which seeing somebody who is destroying something wants to destroy something. And the Buddha said, that's the cycle of samsara. And it just keeps going. But it doesn't have to. Responding selflessly, we think in our mind, should mean that everyone is saved, everyone is happy. But it doesn't mean that. Responding selflessly is just that. It's selfless. One action alleviates another's suffering. Another action does not. Both are coming from selflessness. It doesn't mean that we're enlightened and we know in every moment the right thing to do, or suddenly have absolute power, right? The Buddha in his own lifetime encountered students and groups of students that were acting out, and he went to them and offered teachings and said, look, this is not okay. Like, if you're going to be monastics, you got to be monastics. That's not what's happening here. Come on. And they said, leave us alone. We're going to do this our way. And he walked away. He couldn't control them, right? And so being enlightened doesn't mean having superpower. Not like that. There can be selfless wisdom and compassion in any action, moving in accord with time, place, and conditions. And that is bringing that compassion, wisdom into that moment of suffering. And there still may be suffering that remains. And so that person in a tree, not making a decision is not an option. Action is called for. How to do that without dividing, but with also without having a fantasized notion that if I have the right intention or if I clarify certain things, that nothing bad will ever happen again. There's nowhere in the teachings where you're going to see that offered to you, right? But what is offered is that we can live a life in which we are finding how to be peaceful in the midst of a lack of peace. We can discover how to be compassionate in the midst of a lack of compassion. We can deal with our own hindrances and obstructions and moments of self-arising in unskillful ways and respond to those in ways that are based in enlightened understanding. And a life is transformed, not just a life, because no one lives in isolation. So when Dai Roshi began this monastery, when the Buddha was enlightened and began teaching, right? They couldn't predict. Well, I don't know, maybe the Buddha could predict the future. My teacher couldn't. People would often ask him, what do you think what's going to be happening here in 10 or 15 years? He said, I don't know. I'm not a prophet. He said, but if we take care of today, then tomorrow we'll take care of tomorrow. You know, an important part of practice is sifting through all the ideas that we create in ourselves. And if we can do that, when we encounter the reality of our lives and what practices that are in conflict with what I thought this was, or with what I want this to be, or with what this should be, and we can yield, we can release that and actually bring the Dharma into that moment, things go differently. So for all of you who are here for the weekend, thank you for sharing yourselves with us. I hope that however things go for you, they go well. We have a seat for you here whenever you'd like to come back. If this is not your path, please keep seeking. Right. The world is in need of people who have some idea of what's going on. Right? Right. We need that. However you find that, make sure it's worthy of the effort you put into it, you know, that it's true, and then make it true, and then we will benefit.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.